A package of 14 bills supported by the California Legislative Black Caucus to address many issues, including homeownership, property tax relief in redlined communities, and a formal apology from Governor Gavin Newsom for California's history of anti-black racism. Mandela Kaisi is an educational and community planning consultant and a member of the City of Los Angeles Reparations Advisory Commission.
There's a large majority of black folks who favor reparations. The skepticism is whether or not any government body will actually deliver. You know, we've never had a moment in our history where reparations was taken up as seriously as it has been in the current era.
The LA Commission is still in its information gathering process and expects to release its recommendations by December. None of the bills currently proposed calls for direct cash payments to descendants of slaves. Advocates note, however, that the U.S. has paid reparations before to Japanese Americans imprisoned in internment camps during World War II. This story was produced with original reporting from Aaron Aubrey Kaplan for Yes Magazine. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 15th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Birdie. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, Catherine Carley, Terry D., Antonia Gonzalez, and Mark Richardson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of the newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth and have a good night.
Yeah. Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Well, you are listening to Cable News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I am speaking with Sarah Wolk, the executive director of Equal Vote Coalition, about star voting, the campaign for it in Eugene, and a statewide initiative petition. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me here, and thanks for covering voting reform.
Yeah, well, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. So, to start, for folks who don't know, what is star voting?
So, star voting is just a preference voting type of way to vote. So, instead of choosing one only, with star voting, when you go to vote, you're able to score your candidates from 0 stars up to 5 stars for your favorite. So it lets you show your preference order and also how much or how little you like the candidate, so that whether or not your favorite can win, your vote always makes a difference.
So take me through this. As, you know, say I'm the voter, I'm ranking my favorites. I have a 5, I have a 3, and I have a 1. How do those end up getting counted towards the candidates in question?
Yeah, so the instructions are super simple. You score your candidates 5 stars for your favorite, 0 for your last choice, and then score the other candidates as desired. You can give equal scores if you like candidates equally, and you can also leave people blank. Then star voting is counted in a simple 2-step process. So it sort of works like a primary and then a general election all in one. And for our local elections, like star voting for Eugene, it actually would completely eliminate the need for a primary election. So the way it's counted, you add up all the stars that everyone was given and find the 2 highest scoring candidates overall. Those are your finalists. Then your vote automatically goes to the finalist that you prefer. So each voter counts as 1 vote in the runoff, and the finalist with the most votes wins.
So what are some of the potential benefits to switching to this method of voting as opposed to, you know, what most folks are used to, which is called like first past the post?
Right. So with our current system, it's very simple. Some would say simplistic, and we do like how simple it is. But the problem is it really only works if there's 2 candidates or 2 political parties in the race. If there's more than 2 candidates with the current system, you run the risk of having a majority coalition who ends up splitting the vote and ending up essentially divided and conquered. So that's the kind of familiar conundrum that many of us have found ourselves in, where we have a favorite, but we don't know if they're actually electable. So we might want to consider voting for the front runner on our side who it looks like maybe has a better chance of winning.
I know that when ranked choice voting, because that's kind of another similar method to star voting, when that's been brought up in different contexts and certain localities have adopted it, there are some expected outcomes about the types of candidates that might result or might benefit from this system. Is that the same thing with star voting as well?
Yeah, and so the current system has polarization really baked right into it. Anytime you do have an election with 3 or more candidates, you run the risk of splitting the vote. And when that happens, it tends to favor your polarizing outlier. And so over time, electing more and more polarizing candidates, you end up with 2-party domination. So ranked choice voting attempts to address that, but it was invented about 150 years ago, and it does mitigate some of these issues. But what we've seen is even in countries that have used it the longest, they're still two-party dominated. They still do elect more polarizing winners than what they should, and sometimes non-representative winners. So we've actually seen that with ranked choice voting around the country, where we've had a couple of races where counterintuitively the candidate who was actually preferred over all others by the voters didn't win the election. So in Alaska, that happened the first time it was used, and there's been a really pretty comprehensive national backlash against ranked choice voting for getting these kinds of sideways outcomes, and they can happen anytime you have close competitive races. So that's really where star voting comes in.
Right. Well, can I clarify one thing? Because you mentioned should, that there's an outcome that should happen and it didn't happen. Can you clarify what you mean by that?
Yeah. So in voting science or electoral science, the idea of like the accurate winner is the candidate who best represents the will of the people. So for instance, if you're ranking the candidates and there is a candidate who is preferred over all others, that candidate should really win, according to the ballots themselves. But ranked choice voting actually doesn't count all the rankings. So in close competitive races, it can sometimes get outcomes that just don't make sense if you really crunch the data.
Well, as you mentioned, star voting is on the May ballot in Eugene. Can you tell me a little bit about this campaign?
Yeah, so we really like to look at it as the evolution of the same movement. Again, star voting was invented to just go further to deliver on the goals behind the ranked choice voting movement while still actually addressing valid criticisms with the older method. So here in Eugene, we've been working on this for a decade and made it on the ballot this year with a really robust grassroots campaign. Over a third of our signatures were collected by volunteers. They were all collected by Oregonians. And we couldn't be more proud of our team and what we've done here, trying to really put star voting on the map and pilot a modern, more robust option.
Is there any event in Eugene's electoral history that sort of spurred this move towards star voting, or as sort of a counterfactual as to why it might be necessary?
Yeah, I think a lot of places do move to voting reform as kind of a referendum on their current elected leadership. And in Eugene, that actually wasn't the motivation. It's actually the opposite. So Oregon has a really long history of leading on voting reform. Oregon was the first state to adopt the primary, to adopt the ballot initiative, to do voter automatic registration, vote by mail. So really the final piece of the puzzle for the Oregon model is to have a voting method that doesn't suffer from vote splitting and spoiler effect, and that really does empower voters to vote their conscience. So we're hoping to pass this in Eugene first and then use Eugene as a model for the rest of the nation, because star voting really does scale well.
So what happens if Eugene's voters in May, what happens if you guys pass it?
Well, if we do pass it, that's kind of where we get to the fun part here. So we've been in campaign mode, trying to really get the message out to voters, doing peer-to-peer conversations and presentations and town halls. We just had a series launch hosted by the Library and League of Women Voters. But if we do pass it, we're going to get to go work on voter education. And that's the part I'm really looking forward to.
Well, I understand that there is also a statewide initiative petition in circulation on star voting as well. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so Star Voting for Oregon has been collecting signatures for well over a year now, and we have until July to make the ballot for this November. And so our hope is that with a win in Eugene, we're going to be able to kind of catapult that recognition and hopefully make it on the ballot for statewide so that we can consider star voting in general. And the benefits of star voting are really exponential as it scales. So one of the things I mentioned being different about star voting and ranked choice is that with star voting, it's all counted with addition, and it's all counted at the local level. So just like our current system, essentially, in terms of the citation details. So that's where I think star voting has something really powerful to offer compared to ranked choice voting that hopefully Oregon will consider and take seriously.
Where can our listeners find out more information if they're interested in your organization or in star voting more generally?
Yeah, our nonprofit is Equal Vote Coalition, and you can find us online at equal.vote. If you want to learn more about star voting specifically, the website for that is starvoting.org.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time to take us through this.
Thanks, Althea.
You have a good one. I have been speaking with Sarah Wolk, the executive director of Equal Vote Coalition, about star voting, the campaign in Eugene, and the statewide initiative petition. You have been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Stay with us.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Matea Carlin. In early March, High Country News released a story about underground seed banks and their possibility for restoring damaged ecosystems and protecting biodiversity. The article highlights how indigenous science and land knowledge is using natural regeneration to restore Western ecosystems that have been damaged by colonization. I spoke with author Josephine Woolington, a freelance journalist and musician based in Portland, Oregon, to learn more. How does indigenous knowledge of the land play an essential role in these restoration efforts in Oregon?
Yeah, so that was one thing that was really striking is the contrast between indigenous scientists versus non-native scientists with more of a Western science background is that the native ecologists really emphasize time and patience and cultivating relationships with plants and with the landscape. To quote Lindsay McClary, again, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde restoration ecologist, she had said something along the lines of, you know, maybe the seed source is there and they just need a bit of time, and that there's value to pausing during restoration projects and to let the landscape talk to you. And so I want to emphasize, though, too, that natural regeneration is not passive. A lot of these tribally led projects took a lot of time, a lot of research, a lot of active restoration. For example, the Still Guamish Estuary, they excavated tidal channels using like a complex mathematical model of how many channels should be kind of maneuvering through the estuary. And so it's not kind of like just kick back and see what happens. It's understanding what the landscape was like kind of pre-colonization as much as they can, and then reconstructing that with patience.
Could you explain the concept of ecological memory?
That term, I might have come across it in a scientific article. I think about seed banks, and I've seen it appear in other writing about restoration. And so for me, how I interpret it is, for example, there's a former lake in the Willamette Valley called Lake Labiche, and it's has really dark black soils. It's peat, so organic matter that has, you know, plants that have decomposed over the thousands of years. And so that lake, the soil extends down 19 feet at some parts of the lake. And underneath the ground is our seeds and roots and bulbs. And those roots and bulbs and seeds or buds, they're on a different time scale than we are above ground. They are not you know, on the same temporal scale. So they can be waiting for decades, maybe even centuries, or there's been research that seeds can come back, you know, after millennia. And so they're waiting for the right moment to regrow if there's enough sunlight. And so for me, it's quite inspiring to think that what was once, you know, a grass seed farm in the Willamette Valley or an onion field in the Lake Labiche example still has the potential, still has that memory underneath the European crops, underneath the agriculture, to return to what the landscape was prior to colonization.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring up colonization. Could you speak a little more on what the role of colonization is in this issue and how you discuss it in your article?
Yeah, I mean, it's really colonization is, I mean, you know, the really the heart of it, because it had transformed landscapes and people's lives and connections to these places so immensely. There, some places, you know, how water flows through our watersheds has been turned completely upside down by irrigated agriculture, by dams that were all because of colonization. Agriculture in the Willamette Valley, you know, this place should be bunch grass prairie. There was tons of camas here, lots of wet swales, wetlands, wapato. But colonization and development has erased all of that. And so with this piece is when we're approaching ecological restoration, how do we keep the values that created these landscapes in the first place in mind during the restoration process? So meaning that prairies, they were created and maintained because of Native people. The Kalapuyans, for example, lived throughout the Willamette Valley. And one of the reasons why they were open prairie is because of their regular annual burns. And so when a non-Native ecologist tries to restore that ecosystem without restoring how it was created in the first place, that raises really interesting philosophical questions about restoration and about how do you restore a landscape that was maintained and created by people, and we're not, you know, able to restore that relationship fully?
In your article, you discuss a lot of fascinating examples of ecological restoration spearheaded by Indigenous groups. Were there any cases that particularly surprised or excited you?
So I think one of the ones that was the most surprising to learn about is sand dunes. And so native plants have returned within the Oregon Dunes National Recreational Area on their own after the Forest Service, which manages the dunes, bulldozed and has used some herbicide on the European beech grass. And so that's the, you know, golden grass that we as Oregonians are very familiar with on the coast. And I think it was so surprising because I guess I had never really thought about what would have grown on the dunes. You know, growing up in Oregon, you kind of think that this colonized landscape is natural and what it has always looked like. So clear cuts in the Coast Range or the beach grass just creating a monoculture of basically like a wheat field along the ocean. But once the Forest Service started bulldozing some of the beach grass, dune plants like yellow sand verbena, which is a really cool succulent dune plant that grows in huge mounds and has an edible taproot with really pretty and fragrant yellow flowers that bloom in spring. That plant has come back and it's culturally important to people along the Northwest coast. But I spoke with Ashley Russell of the Coos Lower Umpqua Siuslaw tribe. And so other plants have also returned in the dunes as well. Beach lupin or seashore lupin, beach morning glory, yeah, I can't think of any others. But and so these plants have come back without any reseeding. And what I find interesting is that the Forest Service, though, is still kind of insisting that it needs to seed to get native plants to come back. And so this is an example of, well, if the plants are already coming back after, you know, only just maybe a year or a couple of years, why is there that urge to kind of force it or think that we need to have a heavier hand if the plants are kind of like, you know, responding to the restoration that's already been done?
What do you hope people take away from this article?
I think the biggest takeaway that I would, theme that I would hope people would take away is that a lot of restoration tends to be one size fits all. There's kind of the feeling that we broke it, we need to fix it. So restoration projects tend to be kind of cookie cutter. You clear invasive plants and then you plant a bunch of seeds or plantings. And that's kind of how it's approached in a lot of areas. But from talking with Indigenous scientists is that is just kind of the opposite of how, you know, we should be approaching restoration. Is plants return to landscapes in stages. It takes a lot of time. Sometimes a site or a landscape might not be mature enough to be able to sustain certain plants that are, found in more mature landscapes. So like camas or wapato or sagebrush, they might not regrow immediately. So a lot of grants for restoration, they fund just 3 to 5 years of work, but plants are on a different time scale, and 3 to 5 years is a very short time. And we can't really expect to recreate these ecosystems kind of in an instant. And so that kind of Western urge to force things and do things quickly is just maybe not the best approach to ecological restoration. And maybe we need to listen to these or look to these tribally led projects that value time and trust.
If our listeners are interested in engaging more with your article, how can they do so?
Yeah, so the article is online at High Country News. The website is hcn.org. I would love it if anyone wanted to reach out directly to me. My direct email is my last name, Woolington, Woolington, Josephine, Josephine, @gmail.com. And I always love hearing stories, maybe if you've experienced natural regeneration in your life or in any area that you have helped restore.
Do you have any last thoughts you'd like to share?
I think one of the more striking aspects of reporting this story was learning that what we see above ground is not necessarily the entire story of a landscape. A farm, for example, a grain field could be restored back to a wetland because the seeds and the bulbs are under the ground. And so I think it's really important to keep that in mind with ecological restoration. You know, you might go into a site and it's covered in reed canary grass, which is a invasive grass that takes over. But underneath the ground, there actually might be more native seeds than reed canary grass. Another example is there's been some interesting research from the University of Montana where a site covered in cheatgrass was actually found to have more native seeds underground than the cheatgrass above ground would have suggested. So we can't really make assumptions about what we see above ground and a site's potential because it's kind of hidden, and that ecological memory, as we talked about earlier, can be reawakened if we approach it the right way.
That was Josephine Woolington, a freelance journalist and musician based in Portland. We discussed her article in High Country News called Underground Seed Banks Hold Promise for Ecological Restoration. The article is about the ways that indigenous science and knowledge is using natural regeneration to restore Western ecosystems. More information at hcn.org. You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Matea Carlin.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM.